From Witbank, South Africa, that's trumpeter, flugelhornist, cornetist, composer, and singer, Hugh Ramopolo Masekela with 10 Minutes Older, The Trumpet. It's his contribution to a 2002 project in which 15 artists, he was among them, of course, were asked to interpret the meaning of time in 10 minutes of film. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we'll be picking up in the second half of our program where we left off yesterday talking about the duopoly. Now that we've had 5 Republican and 3 Democratic debates, we've seen a winnowing of the ranks of the 2016 presidential contenders, but we've also seen a sharpened political difference and political differences between the two main parties and the candidates running under their banners. We'll be talking about what your views are about the new lows to which it seems American politics has descended. But first, a couple of notes on issues in play and a story I want to bring to your attention. And it concerns a group that has been tracking police killings. They've begun to do this. This is now the 3rd year, I believe, that they've been doing this. And, excuse me, I'm going to cough for a minute. Okay, thank you, sorry. They have tracked that 1,152 people so far have been killed by police this year. And I want to read you the Reuters story reporting this. Police in the United States killed at least 1,152 people in the United States this year through December the 15th, with the largest 60 police departments disproportionately killing black people, according to data compiled by activists who run the Mapping Police Violence Project. The group said most police departments did not provide numbers on officer-involved fatalities, so its data comes from 3 crowdsourced databases: fatalencounters.org, the U.S. Police Shootings Database, and killedbypolice.net, as well as research through media, social media, obituaries, police reports, and other sources. 40% of people killed by police in the country's 60 biggest police departments were black, while the African-American population in those jurisdictions was 20%, the report said. The group, formed by data scientist Samuel Sinyangwe and activists Jonetta Elzey and DeRay McKesson, said the 2015 figure compares with 1,172 last year and 1,140 in 2013. The group says it believes its database reflects 90% to 98% of police killings since 2013. The project compiles data on all fatal issues of force by the police, including gunshot, asphyxiation, vehicles, and tasers. It includes unintentional killings, such as people who died of a medical emergency while being arrested or restrained, and off-duty incidents. Police killings, especially of black people, have sparked protests in a number of U.S. cities over the past year and a half. Although such killings are not new, for example, New York police shot and killed more than 40 people a year in the 1970s, and now shoot and kill about 12 a year. Widespread use of phones to record video, as well as police body cams and dashboard cameras, have renewed focus on the use of lethal force. Videotapes have raised questions about officers' justifications of shootings, such as saying the suspect had pointed a gun at or weapon at them or advanced on them. Now, that is shocking by any standard, that in the middle of all of what we're hearing as the dominant concerns of America in this political season, that this report will be presented. What is more shocking is that it is not coming from the Justice Department, although the Justice Department actually has the responsibility for collecting data on the use of force, and particularly because it is its mandate. It is the mandate to keep track of these things in order to find what U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch says are patterns and practices of police departments. This is how you track them. But the reform, quote unquote, that is being discussed with regard to police killings is administrative and not with the idea that they ought to pursue prosecutions. Why aren't police departments reporting these figures as warranted and as required to the Justice Department? And why is a Justice Department not able to present a correct and accurate picture of this particular problem? Nor is the Justice Department apparently tracking this matter, this horrible problem that has persisted for so many years. Again, I come to the conclusion, it's because the vast majority of people who are dispatched from this earth in whatever way by members of various police departments in various cities across the country, they are deemed not to be people that you ought to be worried about. They come from politically unprotected communities, and they are seen as just members of a dispensable population. And in any event, we will hear time and again that, yes, there is a problem with police killings, but it pales in comparison to so-called black-on-black crime. Now, the issue here is we have essentially agents of the state maintaining a frighteningly high number of casualties caused to specific communities, overwhelmingly African American and Latino. 1,152 people a year. You can just look at it from that point of view. It's 1,152 people this year alone, ending in December the 15th. But let's understand what that number suggests. And the report is saying this number may or may not be actually larger than what is reported, but through the best efforts of citizens who have assigned themselves as citizen watchdogs, if you will, we get to have this information available. But a number like 1,152 now has to be translated into what that really means. The 1,152 people who have been killed by police this year are part of systems. They're part of family systems. So for every one person killed, I would conjecture that you would have at least 3 to 4 or maybe more people directly affected by their deaths. And it ought to concern us that their deaths are caused by agents of the state. Uniformed agents of the state and of cities and municipalities and counties who are paid with tax dollars. So these in effect, you can argue, these are paid executions. And the Department of Justice, it seems to be, ought to have had by now a handle on this problem, and not just to talk about administrative, quote, reforms, unquote, but to interpret the figures differently. The figures suggest that this is normal. In other words, for the past 3 years, we are talking about 1,100 people a year being killed by police. Now, this is not on anybody's political map. None of the candidates running see this as a major issue. Not at all. And when groups like Black Lives Matter and other organizations that are organizing against this to bring awareness to this, what do we have? We have a crackdown on them. So at the same time that we recognize there's a problem, we have the official response, by the way, coming from an African-American woman who is the nation's top prosecutor. I have referred to this question before, literally telling the country and telling all parties concerned, do not look to this Justice Department under my authority to address the question of putting people in jail who commit these kinds of crimes. I'm interested in how best do we shape up the administration of justice and criminal justice services and law enforcement services. I'm not talking, and she was explicit, I am not interested in people. Who did what and who should pay? Now, here is where we come to the question of defining one's political interests. Simply because the candidates running don't recognize this as an urgent matter, as a major problem that requires extraordinary attention and immediate attention with the aim of resolute action, doesn't mean that people shouldn't put it on the map. You see? So this is what I mean. The media doesn't find this to be a major problem. It becomes a problem when literally they can't avoid covering it because it has blown up. It has a profile now. And it's newsworthy because so many people are involved in opposing, in demonstrating, in raising the alarm. So they can't avoid the issue, so it's covered. But it is not constituting, in the minds of the media, enough of a problem to consistently raise the question and consistently make people accountable for it. We have today the Democratic Socialist, Bernie Sanders, saying outright that in the non-indictment of anyone responsible, being held responsible for the death of Sandra Bland, the young woman who, after being arrested for a traffic infraction, is taken to a local jail and within a matter of days is found hanging in her jail cell, and it was ruled a suicide. Okay, the wheels of justice basically took on its usual task of investigating, and this matter was referred to a grand jury. We don't know what was presented to the grand jury because the grand jury proceedings are secret. But just yesterday, the grand jury determined there is no reason to indict anyone in her death. She killed herself, essentially. And now, the attorneys for the family are asking for an independent inquiry, and they want to see the evidence that was put before this grand jury that influenced the grand jury's decision. The point I'm making is here was a case that got incredible amounts of coverage. Even the actual footage from the dash cam of the encounter between the police officer and Sandra Bland. By any definition, it was a questionable arrest. By any definition. The fact that a death followed within days of this arrest, where the officer threatened to, quote, light her up if she did not follow and obey his orders, meaning that he was going to taser her when she objected to being compelled to get out of her car and then to stop smoking. And it went to incredible levels of tension right after that, and then again taken to jail, and days later is found hanging in her cell under rather mysterious circumstances. There's no film footage. We were told there's nothing that showed it. But we have, just the same, to place our faith that the prosecutor in the case actually meant to investigate this properly, and that the presentation before the grand jury was comprehensive and fair and unbiased, or that there was an intention from the very beginning that nothing happened here, and there was just a need for the grand jury to officially sign off on that premise that nothing happened here. Now, given the fact of this alarming regularity, I'm quoting again the number, 1,152 people killed this year, including Sandra Bland, one would think the Justice Department would take an active look at this case and all similar cases, because the system cannot be trusted. The cops are not even reporting. The police departments are not reporting to the Justice Department facts and figures that they are required to do. Required to report. They're not reporting these things. They're breaking procedural law, administrative rules. But suddenly, the people are supposed to trust a system that takes no punitive action whatsoever against police departments and the police officers working in those police departments who break the rules, routinely break the rules. I can tell you that if any politically empowered group in these United States suffers the loss of 1,152 of its members in a year, inevitably, there would be such a hue and cry. There would be such an outrage about it. There would be such a demand to look into this pattern and to investigate, not just for procedural purposes, but to find out who is going to pay for this level. This is, in my view, this is literally genocidal in intent. And that's the only way we could see it. And that's how enormous the problem is. You would say, well, gee, 1,152 people is no big deal. It's a fraction of the population. And that's the way people would present it, because the people who come from these communities who are directly affected are determined and have always been determined to be dispensable. Yes, you know, from time to time, when something is particularly outrageous, we'll stop and we'll have a big public outcry. But predictably, life goes on as usual. And instead, we are directed to concentrate on gun violence, as if this is not, in part, gun violence. And we are encouraged to see the bigger problem. And the bigger problem is black-on-black crime. You see? Well, let's talk about black-on-black crime for a minute. There's nothing particularly unusual about black-on-black crime, if one understands what crime is and how crime is committed. What is extraordinary about so-called black-on-black crime is that the very thing that it's supposed to be understood as is the thing that is ignored. Black-on-black crime has less to do with crime in and of itself and more to do with conditions that produce criminals and crime. Well, is it unusual for black people to kill other black people? Any more so than the mafia killing other mafia people? Or Chinese people killing other Chinese people? This is the nature of crime. Albanians kill other Albanians far more regularly than they kill anybody else. Latinos kill other Latinos. It's the nature of the crime. People tend to kill people they know, and people tend to kill people right in their neighborhoods. This is the nature of the crime. There's nothing special about, and there's nothing especially pathological about it in that sense. I'll tell you what the pathology comes in. So crime, the crime of murder, has its own profile. So the notion of black-on-black crime is not a departure from the norm in terms of how these kinds of crimes occur and the nature of these crimes. Every ethnic group experiences the same thing. The people who are killing Chinese people are other Chinese people. Italians are killing other Italians far more regularly than they're killing anybody else. Lithuanians are killing other Lithuanians. Orthodox Jews will kill other Orthodox Jews more regularly than they would kill anybody else. That's the nature of crime. This kind of crime. What is especially important for people to understand, and this is where they will never link this aspect to crime in our so-called black-on-black crime category, is that it is a direct outgrowth of oppression, a direct outgrowth of denial of opportunity, a direct outgrowth of just insanely high unemployment, a direct outgrowth of intolerable poverty, a direct outgrowth of targeted annihilation by systems. You create a situation where neighborhoods become tinderboxes, neighborhoods that are filled with angry people who see no hope of getting anywhere in life And I'm not trying here to excuse anything. I'm saying that we have to understand that crime in particular communities have a specific genesis to it. Crimes have a specific genesis to it. And this is why we need to interpret these killings by police as a specific aspect of the system's directed action against these communities, having agents of the state being tax-paid executioners of these targeted citizens. Now, that is what should inform the reaction and the activism. That is what should inform the creation of alternative systems that are controlled in our community. That is what should inform the way we view this, not in any way trying to explain it away, to justify it. Crime is not justifiable. Killing each other is not justifiable. But we also must realize there's a difference here. There is a very clear difference between police killings and people killing each other. They may be connected, but there's a very acute difference. In all of these cases that we have been discussing, and we've had the good fortune of the guidance of Alton Maddox, who has been dealing with these issues at a legal level, but in terms of understanding, as he talks about, he merges history and military science, as he says, with legal strategies. This is what is needed. And we can't get the system off the hook, you see. And we can't go for the okey-doke that, this is, you know, well-deserved. We're sorry that, you know, Joe or Mary or Sue was killed, but, hey, you know, they played a role in it. And this is what you get. No. Everybody ought to stand up and say, we really see this as fascism. This is what Clara from Philadelphia was telling us yesterday. A fascist state will justify this kind of genocidal action by saying, well, you know, the system has determined that the police officers acted within departmental guidelines. Oh, here we have a person doing lethal harm to herself. And there need not be any further questioning or investigation about it. The system has determined she died as a suicide. No. We have to reorganize our thinking. And this issue should be pivotal in the way we reorganize our thinking, especially with respect to our political choices and our political consciousness in this political season. I'll take a little bit of a break here, and we come back and we connect with each other and we pick up from where we left off yesterday, right after this. Thank you. listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I am Eutrice Lead, and this is the time we are going to connect with each other and pick up from where we left off with each other yesterday. We're talking about the two wings of a flightless bird, Democrats and Republicans. We have just completed the most recent round, 4 days apart, by the way, this month in December, with the showdown in South Carolina looming next month in January on the 14th and on the 17th, respectively. Republicans and Democrats will have another round of their so-called debates, and we will, of course, be I don't know what we will be. I just can't believe that we are to accept this, whatever this is, this low grade of intellect, this myopic vision that is seems to be universal here, and they all agree. I mean, they're all pretty much falling into line with that very decidedly under par way of looking at things and, of course, planning things. But no question, we see a very rightward shift here occurring with the complicity and even with the eagerness of the media, creating a false reality and putting it before the populace as, in fact, the reality, not interested in really getting to the structural issues here. And it seems to be a major flaw, a major failing in this election cycle. But, of course, you know, that is planned and it's deliberate. And it has to do, as we've been discussing, it has to do with a lot of money that the media are expecting to yield from this election cycle, which is estimated at least $5 billion will be spent in campaign marketing and advertising. So to make the case that they deserve a nice chunk of it, each of the media outlets that is hosting these so-called debates, playing it cool. They're not trying to ruffle anybody's feathers. And if they do, it's not too much. It's, you know, these are survivable things. But you'd notice there's no indicting story coming around now. Nobody's really digging up the dirt. And here's what's funny. Right in your face is Hillary Clinton, the most nearly indicted first lady of this nation ever. The most investigated first lady ever, the most investigated public servant that we've seen in a long time. But as pure as the driven snow, and everybody's presenting her as like, Hillary is the standard bearer. It's a foregone conclusion in the same way that she was the U.S. senator to represent New York. That was a foregone conclusion. So she left the White House and was able to walk into the U.S. Senate as her first publicly elected office. And it's now championed. She talks about, you know, her public service. It's hysterical. It is hysterical what's going on. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. What are your thoughts? What are your opinions about where things are standing now in terms of the aggregate view of what we are supposed to accept as politics in this country at a time when the big office is up for grabs? The White House, everybody's vying for it. But what are they saying? What is it that you're getting from this whole process? What should we be getting ready for, getting ready to do? How is it shaping your attitudes? How is it shaping what you're thinking as a politically conscious person? 888-874-4888. We have today the big defense against Hillary because Donald Trump, being the, you know, the crude thug that he is, made a very crude and thuggish comment about her because she apparently took a bathroom break and is now all over the news. Why would he attack her? I mean, serious issues are going on. And we have this, these, the, like little children who can't behave. Joel, you're on the air. Tell us what you're thinking.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good. So, you know, the campaign now is in full thrust, I guess, as it has been for a number of months now. And you know what? I just want to turn my radio down so there's no confusion, if you don't mind.
Thank you.
Okay. And, you know, what strikes me about the campaign, and I don't think it's so unusual because I think we've seen this in many other presidential and senatorial and congressional campaigns, even in local and state campaigns, and many of your listeners have talked about it, I know I've talked about it, is the air of unreality that layers the totality of the campaign amongst all the candidates, including Sanders. As far as the Republicans are concerned, I don't even think we have to talk about them, except for the phenomenon of Trump, which represents a new kind of experience in the Republican drama. But essentially with the Democrats, I mean, I really don't think that they're really discussing anything that bears any semblance to reality. If you think about what is going on, I just finished reading, by the way, a piece in the London Review of Books by Seymour Hersh. You can't get published in the New York Review anymore or the New Yorker, and all about the dissension within the American military about Obama's policy in Syria. They all understood how dangerous it was to provoke Russia and could get nowhere with him, especially General Dempsey, who retired. Now he has a much more compliant military leadership to work with. So a rather ominous article. But the point I'm making is that if you look throughout the political arena, you'll see that the policies are really geared to areas that bear no resemblance to reality, whether it's the Ukraine. I mean, the astonishing thing that has happened in the Ukraine is that we have now moved into a position of really taking us very close to war with Russia, and we have done this with very little discussion in the United States about what is going on, nor has there really been any real discussion about the actual facts of the Ukrainian embroiler. Instead, we get these platitudes and bromides that are repeated by the candidates. Even though the Democrats are not talking about the possibility of total war, which the Republicans gleefully, you know, refer to, the fact is that the Democrats accept the very basis of the national security surveillance state, warfare state. They accept it. And the policies that are built around that, even if the policies have no basis with reality. The other thing that I find so amazing is that there's hardly any discussion of the imminence of economic collapse and no discussion of the real dangers brought about by the possibility of abrupt and sudden climate change. Those are the realities, and these are realities that are so profoundly important that it seems to me that we should drop everything and talk about these things right away. And yet there is no discussion about them anywhere. And it seems to me that when you get that kind of divorce from reality, that we're in really big trouble. And the only other thing I wanted to say about all of this is that I think we're wasting our time worrying about the possibilities of a Democratic administration or Republican administration. We're wasting our time worrying about whether or not Trump is the candidate, what a Trump-Clinton race would mean for the country. It'll be bad. We all know it'll be bad. And what we really need to do, and what I think I've been saying, and I know you've been saying it for years now, is that we need to recognize that the only way that we make change is through popular movements. We also have to remember, and the left is really needs to be criticized about this. I don't have time to talk about it now, but I'll say it anyway. And that is that the left has failed to remember that their objective is not really to take power, but to create movements and to bring about change through the creation of movements. I mean, slavery wasn't brought about by the Liberty Party, but they had a profound influence on the Republican Party despite all of its flaws. And the same thing was true of feminism. The suffragist party didn't attain power, but they were able to insinuate themselves into the Democrats and Republicans to lead to this expansion of rights. And the same thing was true with the Socialist Party and the different socialist parties that existed around the turn of the 20th century, right into the Communist Party of the 1930s. These people profoundly influenced labor legislation for the better. And that's because they created popular movements. And that's what we have to do. We have a whole significant body of people who are suffering tremendously. And it really represents the majority of the country, whether you're talking about old people who've been screwed by low interest rates, or the dispossessed in cities, or the profound racist attacks that continue unabated against African Americans. We have the majority. What we need is the will, and we need the recognition and the willingness to state that both these parties are moribund, comatose, and ossified, and that the only way that we're going to effectively make change is to get out on our feet and start organizing and start to recognize that we can create this kind of grand coalition. And really, we have no other choice, because what is facing us is a profound economic collapse unlike anything that it's going to make 2008 look like a waltz in the park, and it'll probably be greater than the collapse of 1929 as well. We're talking about banks collapsing, insurance companies collapsing, millions of foreclosures. It's all going to come. We just don't know when it will come, but it's going to come, and it may even happen before the election starts. So we have a lot to really think about, but we need to think realistically and stop being as befogged and clueless as we seem to be, because we're wasting our time.
Well, I could only say amen, amen, and amen to what you've said here today. And that's the whole point. We need to get movements going and, you know, not wait for something to trigger us into action, something more. We have more than enough reason to be triggered into action. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. Thank you for calling and starting this discussion today.
You're welcome.
From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. And you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. And good morning from California to all the PRN listeners. I hope everyone is having a superior and great holiday season.
Thank you.
Joel made some very, very interesting points, and I agree with most of everything that he said. And basically his last point was that the Democrats and Republicans are the same, so we need to just get our own movements to influence the Democratic Party or a third party. And speaking of third parties, I'd like to recommend an interview that I saw, was just watching yesterday. It's an interview by the Young Turks online, TYT. They have a section now called TYT Interviews. And it's an interview with Jill Stein, Dr. Jill Stein. Very interesting. And it brought back some thoughts that my professor, Ms. Professor Eutrice Lead, brings up all the time about the Green Party. Jill Stein, of course, is running for the nomination for the Green Party. She was talking about the current state of the race, talking about the Republicans, talking about Bernie Sanders, talking about Hillary Clinton. And what brought you to mind was when they got around to the Black Lives Matter movement and all of these police killings. Of course, Dr. Jill Stein, I think she's a great person. I think she really does care about the situation in this country. I have nothing bad to say about her. She just seemed a little awkward when talking about this. Of course, she's a graduate of Harvard Medical School, and I doubt in her practice she's ever dealt with a lot of black people. So This is that awkwardness that you talk about, Eutrice, when the Green Party doesn't know how or doesn't put an effort into reaching out into our communities. Now, the things she said were spot on in a macro sense, but she didn't delve deep into it. For an example, she said that the average black person has maybe a 14-year less lifespan than the average white person. And the interviewer, Cenk Uygur, asked her, well, why do you think this is? And she said, at one point she said, well, 7 years just for being black. She said that two or three times without delving into the issues behind that, like the unfairness and medical, treatment and medical, food insecurity, the poorness in the ghettos, the toxic. She said a little bit about the environmental racism, but then the other 7 years, I don't think she ever got. It was just a really awkward feeling, like she didn't really know what to say. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I'm listening.
I mean, and this brought you to mind because you always make that point that they do not connect with the black and Hispanic communities. And I think it's because in their experience, maybe they need new advisors. Maybe you should be an advisor, Eutrice.
No, you see, the thing is, they don't need any advice. What they are demonstrating, like when they have this public opportunity to connect, and the discomfort tells you all you need to know, and that is
right. They
are still shackled with the vestiges of white supremacy. They're not comfortable talking to people, and yet there is a ready population willing to listen to what you have to say. But I
Absolutely.
Have not seen the Green Party being aggressive in getting the message and looking into these communities to find ways in which they can establish, some kind of a stronghold here. Then they don't act like they're interested. And worse, I've said before, they don't act like they want to win anything.
Right, right. Well, yeah, there's just this, she talked about coalitions and how we need to bring the 40 million students that are in debt or young people that are in debt together with the Hispanic community and other people who are outraged about things like, the immigration issues and Black Lives Matter people. We'd all need to come together. But tell us how we do that. You're trying to be the leader, so tell us how we do that. And I thought it was just very, very... just an overview she was giving and not really any details. And they had plenty of time for her to delve into it. So I thought it was very interesting. Eutrice, one last thing I'd like to say before I get off is that I heard about the study groups. I haven't had a chance to listen every day intently, but because I've been working so much. But I'm going to make an offering this Friday. I have a phone system where I can do up to 100 people conference calling, or 150 people, and we can all be on the line together and discuss things and stuff like that. It's like a custom conference calling feature. So on Friday, if it's okay with you, I'll give out the number for people to call in, and I'll leave it open for maybe an hour or two after the show for people
to
just
talk to each other. That's fantastic.
Okay, so we'll do that on Friday. I'll call back, and I'll give the number.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Well, thank you for calling. We have room for a couple more calls at 888-874-4888. This is what is important. We have people in all these different places who are noticing the same thing, and that is the need, as Joel said today, and as DX said, we need to not wait anymore, but begin the process of activism wherever we are, based on the things that are extremely important to us. We don't need the media to define that. We don't need politicians to define what is important to us, and nor do we need anybody to tell us that what we think is important is, in fact, not important. If police brutality is an important issue, then people have to just accept it. Those who don't accept it, tough. But keep plugging away at the issues that are important to you, because after all, this is what politics is all about. People advocating for their interests and looking to their interests and making sure that some penalty is paid when their interests are not paid attention to. We see on the left a kind of malaise, but we definitely see the consistency here, when I'm going back to the Green Party. Now, here's a party that has a perfect opportunity to connect with communities that could use their help, but they act like they just don't know. How do we do that? I mean, geez, as if it's any different from the way you connect with any other constituency. Clarence from the Bronx, you're on the air.
Hello, Yatrice. How you doing?
Fine, thank you. And you?
Okay. I'm doing great. I just want to turn my radio off because show is the only show that I listen to your show. It's just so great, you know, sanity-wise. Because I watched the news and I couldn't believe it that they didn't have not one ounce odor about the cop in Oklahoma raping those 13 black women. It wasn't on the news, it wasn't in the paper, it wasn't anywhere. And I thought that should have been a major story.
Well,
I thought that should have been I asked people on the street, just generally guys that I know, I said, you know about the cop raping the women in Oklahoma? And they said, no, they never heard about it. But it's just so bizarre how the media does things like that. Like today they're giving Donald Trump a whole hour. It's called Citizen Trump on CNN, a whole hour of free publicity. You know, I think about you, you said the free publicity. They're giving Trump, like, all this publicity for free. And it's just amazing how, you know, they're doing that, you know.
Well, isn't that amazing? They're hoping, again, that when he opens up the purse, that they'll be first in line and they'll get the lion's share of his campaign money. That's what it's all about. It really isn't anything more complicated than that.
Yeah, but he said that the last debate that he wanted them to pay him $5 million to be in the debate, or he wasn't going to be in the debate.
Sure, because he's brazen, and this is what he sees. He knows that he has them where he wants them. He has the media where he wants them. He has created, for CNN, for example, he's actually created an audience. CNN has been losing viewers like crazy. And with the loss of a viewership, you have a loss of advertising revenue. So Trump has been great for the media generally. And so they do whatever it is that they think they need to do to be in his good graces, and hoping that he has a long enough memory so that when the time comes to start doling out the money, and it will be soon, because now we're in at the cusp of the last lap toward the finish line, he will dole out, he will remember that they gave him all this free time, that he will remember that they gave him all this favorable coverage, and he will reward them when they make their presentation for a huge chunk of change. This is what is going on.
Yeah, it's money. It's all about the money.
So, Clarence, what is your, if we could give me a fast a review of, what is your attitude now about politics?
Well, I started out with politics back in 1976 with Jimmy Carter, and I finally met him, and I stayed with politics for a long time. But not just so recently, when Obama became president, that I really realized that the president is just a guy with a job. He doesn't run anything. You know, it's the corporations that run America, and they're just yes men, bag men, or whatever you want to call them. So I don't look at the presidency anymore for what they can do, because if I wanted to, you know, pick people that do anything, I would vote for ExxonMobil or Westinghouse or one of those guys, because that's who's running the country, not the president. You know, it's the 1%. It's not you. He was, I don't know where they got Obama. I voted for him one time, but I didn't vote for him the second time.
What are you likely to do this year?
Excuse me?
What are you likely to do this year?
Well, I they're all the same. I mean, if Trump wins, they want Trump. I'm sure they're pushing for Trump because I guess he's with the military industrial complex. They want somebody who's willing to bomb and destroy to keep them with their phony baloney jobs, you know. So they have to have somebody. They have to make ISIS up or somebody up to keep them working. I mean, after the Cold War, there was no enemies. So they have to look and figure out who do we keep to keep our jobs. We got to keep working, you know. So they have to find, they have to make up somebody. So they did a great job in the Middle East. They destroyed the Middle East. They destroyed Saddam. They destroyed Gaddafi. Now it's just a mess, and that's what they love. So they can sell their guns and make their money. Like you said, it's about money. So that's what it's about. I mean, Eisenhower already warned us about the military-industrial complex, but it seems like nobody really understood what he was talking about. And so now we see that that's what runs the country. They get most of the share of the money. I mean, like Trump is talking about building up the military. How much more can you build up the military? I mean, what do you want to do? I mean, I don't know.
Maybe he'll go into the bomb-making business, too, and he'll be excellent, great, magnificent at that. Thank you, Clarence, for calling in today.
Okay.
Thank you for joining me today. We've come to the end of the program. Keep it right here at PRN.FM. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can let me know what you're thinking. Let me know by sending me a note at leadstories@gmail.com. And we'll join each other again tomorrow. In the meantime, know for me, it is a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.